Welcome to Product-Led Growth Leaders, where we learn about the bold path of building digital products that sell themselves. Let's listen to product leaders who can give us a glimpse into the innovative thinking process. Showcasing and celebrating these awesome folks, I'm your host, UX and product design veteran, Thomas Watkins. Welcome to Product-Led Growth Leaders. We've got a really cool guest for the show today, Raj Singh. He is very much a product guy. He has been the head of product. He's been a co-founder and a CEO. Today, he is VP of product and of new products at Mozilla. Raj, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Thomas. Looking forward to chatting.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, one of the things that I think is interesting about you is that you've worked in a lot of different settings and you know a lot of methods to kind of getting things done in the rough world of new products, because new products have to face a new marketplace and they have to be able to try to survive. And there's a certain amount of urgency with that. So, you know, where do you like to start in terms of what people should be thinking about and, you know, when they are trying to do something new and innovative?
So, you know, I think just before kind of diving into that, I think I would separate new product development in a big company or, you know, in any established company versus building your own startup. Certainly when I'm pursuing my own startup, and most of my career has been my own startups, I landed at Mozilla through an acquisition of my previous startup. I bias maybe against best practices on personal pain points. I have a knack for seeing some workflow or something I'm doing, and I'm like, wow, what if I could automate that and make that a little bit easier? And of course, people are like, hey, Raj, you shouldn't lean into something just for yourself. You should look at things that other people experience as well. But I tend to counter, you know, I have the counter position on that. I'm like, if I can solve this for myself, and if there's 10 other people that experience this pain, I'm sure I could find 100, I'm sure I could find 1,000 or whatnot. And so thematically, my career has been exactly that. And that's why I have moved from category to category with either success or failure of different startups. And by category to category, meaning I've been in online dating, I've been in food, I've been in calendar, I've been most recently in meeting summarization, in music. And some of these, you know, in some cases I've exited to Mozilla, Salesforce, Cookpet, public companies. In other cases, we had smaller exits or wound down, but that's been sort of my thematic experience. Now, when you're looking at big company, it's a totally different game. Traditionally, when you think about new product development in a big company, you're looking for adjacencies. So you have your core product that's usually printing money and it's growing and it's scaling. And that audience, it's all about upsell, right? It's all about net dollar retention. Can I sell them more stuff, right? And so you start thinking about, okay, I have this core product. We have millions of customers. What else can I sell them? What else can I build for them? Now, this yields a very different sort of 0-to-1 process, right? You on one hand, you have an audience you can already reach. That's huge, especially in today's world where risk has really moved from technical risk and market risk to really distribution risk. So the fact that you have an audience that you can already touch and talk to, that's a massive moat advantage, whatever you want to call it. But the process is quite different. You have to, you know, you build a beta group, you kind of create a concept, you try to build towards it. And this is where I found, and happy to, you know, I don't want to keep running off here. I'm sure you have thoughts and questions, but this is where I found things start breaking down in a lot of companies, because so much of big company talent is built operating a mature product. But new product development, there's no data. It's very intuition driven. You have to have certain conviction. I have a number of phrases around this, and you know, companies suffer from shiny object syndrome and things like that. And so it's a totally different game. And a lot of PMs where you are ladder-based careers, where you basically have figured out a model where you don't fail, right? You know, like you look at how promotions and career level guides work within organizations, they're not really designed for a new product kind of mentality. And so it's a very different kind of archetype. And I actually even have framings around these different archetypes, and I'm happy to go into that. But this is why so many new products fail in so many organizations.
You know, this is so interesting that you bring this up. There's been so many times in my career working with startups or the big companies, but especially I've seen so many instances where a startup inappropriately hires people who are really talented, but for big organizations. And, you know, it could be like a marketing person, or it could be a technology person. And if you've worked your whole career in a super big, super established organization that runs things in a certain way, and it's more machine-like, and people are more cog-like, and not insulting folks in this kind of setting, but you have a much more focused role versus the ultra scrappy, you know, I've been on teams where a group of five developers produces more than groups of 30 developers at other organizations that I've seen. And it's mind-blowing how those things can create such differences.
So I like to ascribe to something, I don't know if you're familiar, it's called Beck's 3X framework. And I think it's a good model for thinking about architects and the folks you hire, and I'm going to kind of dive into it. So the 3X stands for explore, expand, and extract. And you could think of explore, expand, and extract, and you draw it on an S curve. So you can imagine a curve. If you're following my finger, it's a little bit tricky, but it kind of goes, it goes like this, then this is like explore, expand, and then extract. So now the thing is, if you look at like the explore phase of a product, you're probably leaning into intuition, you're leaning into visionary, you're leaning into craftspeople, people who are like very focused on the individual contributor work. You're leaning into people who thrive in uncertainty. You're leaning into a different sort of set of attributes, right? High execution and so forth. As you go into expand, you have your growth team, you start accelerating. There's a little bit more project management. There's a little bit more cross communication between teams. You have some data. And when you're at the extract phase, you're kind of leaning into operators, right? These are people who have tons of data. I mean, you can basically follow like the Google, I don't know if this is like an official meme or not, but they had this thing like, my data trumps your opinion. You know, like you have data for everything. Like everything can be A/B tested, and you're really focused on trying to optimize 0.1% here and 0.2% here. The IC work is very different, and the leadership work is very different. You know, as a PM leader at that level, you're thinking about communication and organizational design and workflows and tools and whatnot. Whereas at the 0-1 level in that explore phase, there's probably not more than one PM on your entire team. So my point is, these are different archetypes. Some people call this craftsperson, visionary, and operators as one kind of model. There's different models for this. I think Uber had a model around this as well. But the general notion here is there are different archetypes. Now, when you think of a large company that's super successful, so you take a Fortune 500 company, they're making tons of money, and all of a sudden, leadership team comes out and says, we need to build a new product in this space. Now, they pull people from their existing team, right? As you fully would expect. But the people they've been hiring for the last X years, they're in the extract phase of their organization. They clearly have a product that's already crushing it. You know, it's an organization where you have 25 different stakeholders, lots of meetings, decision process that's backed by lots of data, you know, A/B test, the privilege to do A/B testing, the privilege to do user research. These are privileged positions. You don't do these in startups because it takes too much time, or you don't have the resources or the money or whatnot, right? And so that's where you have the first disconnect. It is almost sort of a different talent pool. But, you know, this trickles down into a whole number of things. Even the career level guides, when you think about promotions in an operator stage kind of role, you're thinking about number of people you manage. That's typically been the heuristic. Like, oh, you want to become a group PM. Well, this person's managed 10 PMs and mentored 10 PMs. You never hit 10 PMs in your early stage product, but you might be an incredible IC. So even the career level guides are incorrect, right? So the incentive structures, right? Like, you know, when you look at, I like to use this, again, these are not my frameworks, but this is a framework I'm familiar with. Impact, insight, execution, and impact. When thinking about PM and sort of scoring and grading a PM, right? When you're looking at the 0-1, the explore phase or the expand phase, at the explore phase, you're definitely looking at insight and you're definitely looking at, you know, execution. At the expand phase, a little bit more execution and impact. You have some numbers. But when you're at the operator phase, like, you know, the extract phase, it's all about impact, right? It's pure metric driven kind of results, right? And so again, even the way you grade competencies, all of these sorts of things, and for all these sorts of reasons, and this is just one bucket of reasons, there's a whole nother bucket around just the general inertia of companies, legal, administrative, you know, go to market, whether you can do gray patterns, growth hacking has always been about playing on the edge, things like that. for all these sort of various reasons, I'm happy to keep going deeper depending on where you want to take this conversation. It makes new product development much, much harder in ways that you might not expect within a bigger organization. Certainly there's some benefits too, but you know, these are just some of the challenges.
Let's actually continue to unpack a lot of this stuff, because I think this is an interesting topic in this. The 3X framework that you laid out is pretty good. Let's talk about the inertia side of that you just mentioned. How does that dimension play into this?
Okay, so let's take your average startup. Your average startup, I'm going to go through a range of cases, right? So your average startup, you register for your product. There's no email opt-in checkbox. They start sending you newsletters after month one. They might have a terms of service that's half-baked. It's probably missing some GDPR language. It's probably missing some other stuff. They don't even have a proper inbox for takedown notices or whatever, right? Now you got this out there. You're not supposed to be training on this data. You're collecting user data. You've got not zero defect software connecting into other systems and whatnot. You haven't really gone through a security review. You're using whatever tools you want. You see the random GitHub project pop up that does X, Y, and Z, like, sure, here, take my data and run a little review for me, whatever, right? You're doing all kinds of things. These things are necessary in a startup. It lets you go fast, right? This is what creates speed. In a big company, normally, you want to use a new tool, you have to run a security review. You have to run it through some department that's evaluating whether you can play with this. You may not be able to even do attribution. You may not be able to, you know, your UX has to go through an accessibility review because you don't want to get fined by X, Y, and Z country because you're not ADA compliant. I mean, who knows, right? There's a whole gamut of different possible things. This is sort of intrinsic inertia in the process. So that's sort of one part of it. The next part of it, you're in your little startup. You just build. You don't have people around you saying, oh, you know, what's the next milestone? You know, they're not thinking 2 years. They're thinking like 3 months. And then 6 months later, they come and say, hey, Raj, I like what you're doing, but did you see this other cool shiny object here? What if we go do that? Like, you don't have distractions like that where people are trying to pull you in different directions, because the company rewards shiny objects. The company rewards, like, what is the current hot thing? And the conviction window, when you look at a startup, it's typically 7 years to liquidity. But in a big company, they're looking for like 1 year, maybe 3 years. They really can't think in that kind of time horizon. And so I call it conviction window, and leadership changes, management changes, and all of a sudden you're no longer the sexy product and you don't have a sponsor, and things fall apart. And so, you know, it's just this sort of internal inertia, you know, of the company itself can create a lot of challenges. Now, the third bucket, growth. Everyone who's done anything in growth knows that at the beginnings of a company, growth is not playing by the book. Growth is playing on gray areas. You look at Facebook, it started as Face Smash, right? You literally were like hot or nodding men and women on a scale. Like, that would not be acceptable today. You look at, you know, Zynga, they grew by spamming the Facebook wall, right? You look at like, you know, in 2018, a large number of SaaS companies doing what they call AISDR, basically cold email outreach, cold LinkedIn outreach, cold Twitter DM outreach, right? You look at growth hacking today, programmatic TikTok, they're spinning up 20, 30, 50 TikTok accounts on multiple devices, popping as much video as you can. I mean, this is social organic growth. You look at the stuff Nikita Beer talks about on Twitter, who's, you know, one of the more prolific sort of growth hackers, talking about spamming the iPhone address book. I mean, these were tactics that people had did. If you look at all of these sort of large consumer products at some point in their growth trajectory, particularly early on, they were playing in a lot of gray areas. And that was necessary. It drove their growth. Then they hit a certain inflection point, and then they start buttoning down and saying, you know what, we can't do this anymore. But the thing is, if you're in a big company and you need to play on the razor's edge, you can't, right? Like there's liability risk on the other side. So how do you play that game, yet you're still expected to drive similar growth? Now, your natural argument would be like, well, you have a different advantage. You can sell to your existing audience, and distribution is the moat. However, in many instances, and again, it depends company to company, usually new products within organizations, you're selling to your core audience. At Mozilla, as a counterexample, we're building for new audience, right? Because the Mozilla Firefox space is mostly an unauthenticated audience. I mean, we're a very privacy sensitive sort of company. And so we don't even have an audience we can reach there. So the fact that we have to build our new audience from scratch and can't lean on a pre-existing distribution channel means we're much closer to a startup than we are to a big company. And so how do you achieve that growth if you can't play on the razor's edge, right? And so, you know, these are just some examples of the natural inertia within large companies, and why, you know, the reality is, if you go across Fortune 500 and you look at heads of innovations and heads of new products, unfortunately, it has not been a great, a great success story. That being said, there are certainly counterexamples, but it's challenging. It's not easy.
So some of those, the nature of companies that are in that extraction phase, creates certain vulnerabilities. There's certain obvious advantages. There's more cash and things like that. But the vulnerabilities seem to create that need that we see, and we could dive into this, of large companies simulating startup environments kind of artificially, where they say like, okay, let's cut out this sort of area, and it's like a laboratory, and like, okay, you folks be in there. We'll try not to interfere,
Yes.
even though we probably will interfere. But so talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, let me give you an interesting example that's very counterintuitive. Startup success is almost correlated with less employees. But if you are in a larger company, how do career level guides work? You want to manage more people. Will a product leader or any general leader in a larger company, even if they're running new products, turn down more headcount? Almost
No.
never. They're going to take more headcount because they want more ownership. What are they going to do with that headcount? They're going to give you abundance, more resources. But if you look at like the hardest decisions in a startup, it's always driven off scarcity because you can't do A and B. You have to choose. And that's very counterintuitive thinking. And so it's sort of like, as a leader, are you focused on your own career growth or are you focused on winning? And they almost come in contention. And so to address some of these sorts of pains, and I think about this a lot, is how can we naturally pretty much create an entire organizational firewall between new products and the core company? And it's not easy, but this firewall extends from everything from the ability to use whatever tools that you need, from how legal reviews things, if they even review things, how you go to market, the growth hacking you need, but completely different hiring plans, completely different career level guides, completely different compensation plans, right? Because of just the general nature of the work. And so it is a lot more different than I think people think. I think there's a natural belief that I can, I've been working in FAANG for 15 years on X, Y, and Z product. I can go do new products. And the answer is I have, from what I've seen and gathered, and again, I'm only one data point, have said that has not increased the odds of success. That would be the nicest way to put it, right? And so, whereas maybe you want somebody who's more generalist, because the nature of new products is much more generalist, big companies tend to hire specialists. You've been doing the same domain, same space for 15 years. I want somebody who has breadth level knowledge of everything from UX to engineering to QA to go to market to pricing to whatever, right? And so, these are just examples of things that I'm thinking about.
Here's a question to which the answer is almost certainly it depends, but I'll just ask it for the sake of fun. What's worse, putting an explore employee in an extract phase organization or putting an extract person? So in other words, putting the startup
Yeah, I see
person
it.
in the big org or taking the high performing big org person and throwing them into a startup.
So I can only share what I would call opinion. And part of that is because I have never really worked in a pure operator level role. Like
Gotcha.
most of my career has been startup. So I can only share anecdotal. My sense would be people at the explore phase are much more curious. Because they're constantly disrupting themselves. They have to play with the new tools all the time. Workflows change. They're totally comfortable with the workflow changing every week. They almost always represent the earliest adopters of like, let's say like Gen AI upskilling, for example, things like that. I'm not saying operators are not in that bucket. That's not what I'm trying to imply. And so my sense would be they could certainly move into an operator role. They would probably do okay, but be incredibly frustrated. Probably do a lot worse when it comes to the cross-team collaboration, the presentations, driving consensus, all the other stuff, which frankly, when you think about extract phase PMs, it's very much about communication and persuasion and all those other like soft skills. They probably would do a lot worse because they've had so much autonomy on that front, but they probably could do the work, right? But it would be a lot of friction and a lot of contention. The reciprocal, if you took somebody from the operator phase and put them into a new product, they would feel very uncomfortable in a different way because they'd be expected to kind of just figure it out and have crazy high agency and just kind of be thrown into it. And if they've never experienced failure, and I do think experiencing failure is one of those, what's the word I'm looking for? Like Like if I was to choose any attribute, like it's one of those attributes which is like the most hard, right? And in the sense that if you've never experienced failure, it's going to be extremely hard. Public failure, just to be clear. And you've always sort of like been able to massage your way to like, progress because your whole career has been given that way. Given that, I think an operator would have a harder time in the explore phase than a visionary craftsperson from the explore phase or playing the role of an operator, because most people in the explore phase have experienced public failure. And public failure, I would almost consider like the like firewall item. Like it's very like most people can't do it. It's very hard. I think ultimately, certainly when I was in my 20s, I thought I could do everything. I'm in my 40s now, and so I have enough introspection to know like what I'm good at and where my superpowers lie, right? And so like that being said, there are things I just simply have not done. I only have heard about it anecdotally, or I've seen it. So I don't know how I would react in those situations, but this would be my quick two cents on where I think it would land.
Let's hear your thoughts on Gen AI upscaling.
Okay, so I think 2 years ago there was, and even today, there's a lot of folks that do not believe it ex improves productivity. I think at this point, my opinion, it's denialism. I have enough data points across enough different functional roles, IC by IC. I don't care if it's UXR versus QA versus engineering versus marketing versus legal versus finance. They're gaining benefit from Gen AI. I think where the problem is the level at which people are using Gen AI widely varies. Some people are using it in the most superficial way, which is fine. It's a way to get started. They're going to ChatGPT and asking questions, and that's great. And other people have gone all the way where it's almost Gen AI native, where, for example, in engineering, you might see a ticket from Linear, have an AI agent will read the ticket, follow the instructions, look at the code, generate the code, and submit a PR request for a human to then review. That's an end-to-end experience. In fact, I actually created a table that I had published on LinkedIn where I built a rubric calling this from like level one to level four sort of use of Gen AI. And the key here was really to create a gamified structure on how to think about different levels and your application of Gen AI, but also to show that it wasn't role specific. Like there's a version of this table. I did a table for engineering, but there's a version of that table for accountants. And there's a version of that table for data science. And there's a version of that table for UX, whether it's prototyping and for PMs and so forth. So naturally, within any organization, and not even within an organization, just across the gamut, there is a natural friction. Like you're dealing with people's workflows. It's super disruptive. Like I'm not used to changing how I take notes or whatever it might be, right? And so the key here I have found is you want to see how other people do it, but you want to see how other people do it in the same functional role. Like it's not as helpful me seeing how finance is using Gen AI if I'm in the PM role, or an engineer seeing how a designer uses Gen AI when they're in the engineering role. They want to see other people in their functional role and how they use Gen AI. So one of the first things I sort of advise is companies should set up try and tell. And the reason I use try and tell versus show and tell is everyone has to participate in the show and tell. And the reason that's important is so much of Gen AI use and adoption is tribal knowledge. You actually have to experience the pain. Like prompting and the process at which you kind of debug and you iterate and go through that cycle, you have to experience it. You can certainly watch 100 YouTube videos, but unless you actually go through it, you don't actually experience it. So it's super important to try. That's kind of the first thing I advise folks to do is set up some bi-weekly se session by functional role to do some sort of try and tell. The second thing I tell people is map out your day. Now, this may sound like a very silly exercise, but if you broke out your day into 10-minute segments or 15-minute segments, can you actually write down everything you did that day and then feed that to ChatGPT or ask yourself and think about, could I have accelerated that part of my day using Gen AI? And how would I have done so, right? So that's just like trying to force the function of like think harder or think deeper about there are workflows you're doing that you may not realize that actually can be accelerated or automated through Gen AI. The third thing that I think is quite useful is that the organization itself has to foster use of Gen AI. And the way we do that is one, let employees use whatever tools they want. Now that sounds crazy, right? Let them expense. If they want to go play with things, let them play with things. Obviously, if you stop playing with it, unsubscribe. But let them expense, let them play with it, encourage it, right? Because the whole point here is we need to experiment and we need to learn, and we don't want to create another level of friction by saying, hey, I want to go try this cool video generation thing. I'm like, fine, I don't care. You're in accounting. Maybe you'll figure out a use case where this is useful in your workflow, and then we could share that with everyone else. So the organization itself has to, let people do this work, give people time to do this work. Some companies are literally taking a week off, saying, hey, spend the week, just play with Gen AI tools, whatever it might be, right? There's many ways to take that approach. But I think ultimately all of this has to come bottoms up organically, right? Leadership leads by example, but leadership can't mandate. And I recognize, again, in the tech sector, we are in some ways used to more disruption, but this is like another level of workflow disruption that people have never experienced. But I know in most sectors, they kind of have a workflow they've established since college, and they may not have changed it, right? And so it's super, super uncomfortable. But I think these are necessary steps because it's becoming increasingly clear that Gen AI is a massive productivity boost. It is creating what I'm calling the super IC. And I actually gave a talk on Maven about this. If I have a deck link offline that I can share. Although I think human in the loop never going away, the work is changing. People are writing instructions and reviewing as opposed to authoring. I think, unfortunately, people who are using Gen AI may end up displacing people who aren't using Gen AI. I don't see AI displacing humans. I'm not in that bucket at all. And I do think tech is very hyperbolic and we like to go with extremes. But I do think there is real risk if you're not adopting Gen AI in your workflow and at least thinking about it.
Could you talk a little bit in the last few minutes? There's a lot of great stuff here about GTM under different circumstances. Go to market, let's say if you're a large organization, you've produced a new product and you're trying to go to market with that versus you're an unknown operation trying to hit the market, you've got no money and some of the different considerations there.
So it's quite different. So normally, again, in a larger company, you're building new product, you're selling to your core product. Most often you see this in B2B companies, they're selling enterprise, they're selling top-down or massively adopted bottoms-up SaaS. So they have big mailing lists, right? So they usually will segment a cohort and they'll say, hey, we have a new product that we'd like you to try. Would you like to sign up for some like list, right? Because their audience is so large, you can almost always certainly get some list. They even have an inside sales team or whatnot that can upsell. So they have some list. They quickly have like, let's say 500 companies on that list, right? So now they have an audience that they can already do UXR against. They can get feedback on, they can run surveys against, right? They run through the normal product process, they prototype a workflow. Maybe they're using Gen AI to build a prototype, maybe they're designing a prototype, who knows? But they're going back and forth, they're testing it, right? And it is tightly coupled with the core product. It may even share common authentication, common backend systems. There may even be some data sharing, probably some separation, but it's a very different kind of go-to-market. Then as they sort of approach the market, now they have a product that they're seeing their beta audience that they've effectively acquired through their core product, adopting and using every day. They're seeing some success. And then eventually, they announce the product, right? And it's an organizational sort of announcement. It's a new upsell for the sales team. It's a new add-on on the pricing page. It's a very different sort of go-to-market. As a PM in that kind of organization, it's not that you're not thinking about go-to-market, but you don't have to hustle it, right? You have a lot more access and audience that you can sell and reach into. When you're thinking about new product and you're not selling your core product, so much more akin to a startup or a big company doing completely adjacent, new product, new domain, new category, et cetera. In this case, you have to build often from scratch, right? And so then I think about like, well, how do I approach this as a startup? Often what I do, and so I can only share my own tactics, I usually start with a mailing list. So every person I talk to about the product, I start adding them to a mailing list. This is my initial set of, let's call it, I was going to say fanboys, but maybe fanpersons is probably better, right? Because it's fanboys and fangirls, right? But this is my initial list, right? Of fans. And I use this fan group as my initial beta list, right? So as I'm kind of building out, I go back to them, I share, I get feedback, I iterate, whatever, right? And then as I sort of get closer to launch, it's a multi-pronged thing. It might be, I have for years have been building myself on social media, right? Whether it's like Twitter or whether it's YouTube or whatnot. So I push through my different channels. I make people aware. By that point, I already have a beta group that's already using it. So it's all coordinated. Everyone sort of pushes. We might then drive into a product hunt launch or something like that, right? It's really a series of games and steps that you might play to sort of create that initial excitement, that initial boost, because you're really banking and hoping on word of mouth virality. And in this market where there is so much noise because democratization of Gen AI and building and just the volume of things being created and signal to noise ratio off the charts, you really need to figure out how to drive what I call WAMO, word of mouth optimization, right? So you want five people to be able to describe your product in the same way. You kind of want to drive it that way. Of course, even better if you've built some loops into your product so you can get new acquisition that way, right? But that's kind of one channel. Now, in parallel, I might be doing a bunch of SEO, answer engine optimization, AEO activities, et cetera, right? I might create a Reddit, I might use a warmed Reddit account that already has a lot of karma and start commenting about something coming in a particular subreddits. I might be doing the same thing on Quora, trying to create a Wikipedia page. I'm basically trying to create backlinks from authoritative sources because I know answer engines like to cite from those kinds of UGC authoritative sources as opposed to long tail media, right? Which historically it was like, oh, go get the CNN, go get the CNN article or go get the, Business Insider article, whatever. That's not driving as much anymore, right? And so, these might be other things I might be doing behind the scenes. I might be thinking about AI SDR and cold email outreach. I might be thinking about programmatic video on TikTok. I might be thinking about, other programmatic landing pages, right? For SEO purposes, right? So there's like ranges of different growth tactics, and that's probably a whole nother topic. I've given some talks on that, like just like dozens and dozens of sort of growth tactics. But it's very different to sort of saying, hey, I'm building a new product and I have an existing customer base. I don't need to necessarily acquire net new. I just need to sell to our existing audience on a product that's already growing, which makes it a totally different game.
Excellent stuff here. Ladies and gentlemen, we've been talking with Raj Singh. Where can folks check you out and see, more material if you're writing out there or just connect with you?
Yeah, so I'm on Twitter at Mobile Raj. I'm on LinkedIn. It's at my full name. It's Rajan Singh, but you can find it at Raj Singh if you search for Mozilla. My Linktree, I think it's slash Mobile Raj as well. And then, I have to give a shout out. One of the products in my team at Mozilla, Solo, AI website builder. So if you're building small business, that's another place you can find me. Check it out, Mozilla Solo. Yeah, so any of those channels, you can reach me, DM me, feel free to ping me.
And any really final product shout outs, because I want to give you a chance to talk about some of the things you're working on. Let's take a minute for that.
Yeah, no, so I'm responsible for new products. I'm focused on the small business community. The reason for that is recognized a couple of years ago that Shopify has really demonstrated that there's an entire universe here for e-commerce. Wix, Squarespace, WordPress, they have become very large and heavy products. I'm not saying that necessarily in a negative way, but they're trying to be all to everyone and felt that there was an opportunity for freelancers, right? And I think I was watching or reading Yahoo Finance and saw that the side hustle was the fastest growing job in the US. And I think it's globally as well. It's sort of the freelancer. And these are service providers. These are people who maybe are mural painters, they're wedding cake makers, they're photographers, they're coaches, they're tutors, and they have a set of needs. And so we created what's called the SMB Studio at Mozilla, and we are building a series of products to serve this community. The first product we've launched is called Solo, which is an AI website builder. We have new products coming in the spaces of social media, blog, back office accounting, virtual receptionist, you name it, just to sort of fill all those gaps. So you can think of what Shopify did for e-commerce, can we achieve for service providers?
Excellent, excellent, fascinating stuff, Raj. Hope everybody checks out your stuff, your work, goes to your Linktree. And Raj, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Thomas. Enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you for tuning in. Join us next time on Product-Led Growth Leaders. Take care.